summer.
Just keeps rolling along.
What is it? July, mid-July anyway. I think it's the 16th. I'm not bad with dates. Yeah. But I'm glad to see that people are out and about in the New York area. And it's wonderful to be able to have a summer that is filled with music, whether it's on the radio or in some of it live, which is really incredible. We can plan on continuing to do what we've been doing for years here on WHPC. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan, here as well, to bring you another hour of How Music Changed. We've been dedicating our time as of late to the history of Duke Ellington. And we are now at a period of time that I would call the leaner years. Mm. To properly celebrate a hero's return to glory, you must follow him down. And this show represents that essential stage where a lesser man may have given up or maybe even complied with the less talented voices who thought that they could tell Duke Ellington what he ought to do. Some were sympathetic friends who meant well, while others were backbiting leeches with nothing but opinionated vitriol. As always, Duke rode above the fray and found his own way. Now, this show covers that battle. And I'm not going to play the songs that pretty much could represent a serious downturn in his career, because the only reason that Ellington was playing songs that were like almost contemptible, even to him, was because this is what labels were giving him, especially RCA, which we talked about how he basically pulled himself free of that label. But times were not good. I'm going to be reading most of today from Duke Ellington's America by Harvey G. Cohen. Alone among their big band competition, the Duke Ellington Orchestra soldiered on without a break through money-losing gigs, record contracts, and projects, financially buoyed by Ellington's royalties. Racial controversies and poor recordings shook his reputation as never before. Ellington persisted nonetheless, creating memorable works as well as some of his least distinguished, keeping the band working during unprecedented bad business conditions and laying the foundation for the stunning and surprising artistic and business successes that he engineered in the mid-50s. In the post-war era, American culture, especially African-American culture, and attitudes towards civil rights were changing. A new generation was emerging, and it took time for Ellington to adjust and to finally master these new realities. For example, here's headlines from the time. NAACP plans to boycott Duke Ellington.
What?
Incredible, right? It's because Ellington was saying things about whether or not it was smart to basically rebel violently. Basically, he just said, one of his quotes was, well, here's the headline. Maestro says, we ain't ready yet. Duke Ellington's views on Jim Crow shock the nation. Reputation shredded. Duke should disband. These are headlines. From the selected Downbeat 1955 Reader's Poll for Best Dance Band. Les Brown won first place with 1,905 votes. Lawrence Welk received 85 votes. Duke Ellington, 52. This is what we're up against.
Oh, boy.
Let's start with a track called I'm Afraid I'm Loving You Too Much. Segued with Juge Juge on American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHPC.
I'm afraid of loving you too much, so afraid of trembling at your touch. This is no time to start flashing your eyes at me. I have to watch my heart. It bruises so easily. insist. There's much too much concern if we kissed. My memories might get burned, and if I fell in love, I might get hurt. Who knows? I'm afraid, but anyway, here goes. Give me that old-fashioned jojo with that old-fashioned sway. Let me dance in that old-fashioned way. Jojo. Give me that old-fashioned jojo with a old-fashioned beat where you don't have to pick up your feet. Jojo. Kind of funny homespunning, long steady roll. Ain't no bopping, ain't no stopping, ain't no self-control. Old-fashioned jojo with old-fashioned jug. Well, an old-fashioned, old-fashioned jug, jug, jug. Oh, give me that old-fashioned jug, jug. Old-fashioned jug. Ah, now give me that old-fashioned jug, jug. With a new claim to fame, but the melodies all sound the same. Cause it's jug, jug. Jug, 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 jug.
I would imagine that you had discerned this already, but of course that is Duke Ellington's solo. Not only playing the piano, but in that instance, providing his own vocals and lyrics. And you hear that he's getting a little bit out of it, out of his system, with how it all sounds the same and basically trying to be a slightly critical, but it's wonderful to hear him sing. I think it's great. Let's play a track by the full band, though, from around this point in time. This is early 1950. The song is named after a catchphrase that Duke used all the time. He would always like sign off with it. If you ever got a Duke Ellington autograph, it would say, "Love you madly, Duke Ellington." This track is entitled "Love You Madly" on American at Radio 90.3 WHPC.
Say to me, I love you
Now, things going so poorly for Ellington, as you said, advice was coming all over the place. And again, reading from Harvey G. Cohen's book, Duke Ellington's America, some of the advice Ellington received during this period, privately and in the press, encouraged him to dismantle his band and find different ways to write and perform his music. Norman Granz described his attempts to put together a deal with Ellington in the late 1940s. The Ellington Band wasn't doing too well, and I had been touring my package of jazz at the Philharmonic, and though it wasn't very successful in the beginning, I had a feeling that it was a question of time before people would begin to accept the concept of having jazz in a concert hall where you had classical music. Anyway, I met Duke backstage at one of these things, and I said, "Why don't you give up the band, and I'll pay you a weekly salary." At that time, it was commensurate with what Duke would net after paying the band. "And any time we get ready to tour, well, then you can hire the cats and you can pay them more and be sure to get them. Then the rest of the time, they'll find other gigs to do. And you can devote your time to writing." Because it came up that he felt that he didn't have enough time, really, to sit down and write something. Economically, it made a lot of sense, of course. But I'm not sure Duke ever entertained the idea. He said no, he really wanted to keep the band together. It was obvious, when I was smarter about the band, that he needed that band just for his compositions, to hear what they sounded like.
Cool.
That became one of
That's
Ellington's...
That's what you were saying before.
Yeah, I mean, the band was his instrument.
Yes.
Because that became one of the Ellington cliches of the future. "That's my instrument. The band." Well, of course, it made sense. But Norman Granz, who started this series of featuring jazz at a Philharmonic Hall, also started a record label called Verve.
Uh-huh.
And in the late 40s, he put together a very special limited edition, 5,000 album limited edition, signed copies of his 78 RPM discs that he called the jazz scene. It featured people like, well, here's a couple of names. Bud Powell, Ralph Burns, Willie Smith, Billy Strayhorn, his songwriter, Coleman Hawkins, Neil Hefti. And the person who kicks it off, of all people, is Duke Ellington featuring Harry Carney and Billy Strayhorn. There's two tracks that they did. One is called Sono, and the other is called Frustration. I wonder where that title came from. On American Radio 90.3 WHPC. This is from The Jazz Scene, now available as a special CD collection on Verve. Thank you. No, it's beautiful. But this is, keep this in mind, this is happening now at around the exact same time that bebop is coming into the forefront of jazz popularity. Miles Davis is doing his own versions of orchestrations with Birth of the Cool. And there's Duke doing pretty much exactly what Miles was trying to accomplish. But people weren't seeing it on those terms. Again, from the Cohen book. At the same time as those recordings were made, Downbeat began criticizing the Ellington Orchestra as the big band era faded and even recommended its termination in 1949. The jibes revealed as much about the current scene and the critics as they did about Ellington and the band. While praising Ellington's past contributions as unparalleled in American music and crediting him as the premier band leader around, these critics found fault with Ellington slipping or failing to top himself. The high expectations Ellington had met in the past brought a harsher critical judgment upon him. Ellington's main competition, they argued, was himself, and in strikingly personal terms, various writers for Downbeat wondered if Ellington was letting them down just as the music scene needed a boost. They appeared to view Ellington as a savior-like figure during troubled times, which may explain the mood of betrayal in some of their writings. More important than whether or not the Duke is better than Woody Herman is the question of whether or not the Duke circa 1946 is better than the Duke circa 1942 or 38 or any other time in the past, wrote Bill Gottlieb under a banner headline that read, "I'm not slipping, Duke Ellington." The height of Downbeat's criticism of Ellington appeared in the June 17, 1949 issue in a front page article entitled "Reputation Shredded, Duke Should Disband." The story began with a bang. Isn't it about time the Ellington Orchestra was disbanded before what was left of a great reputation is completely dragged in the muck? Much has been written about the old-time men in the organization, what a wonderful creative past the Ellington Band has had, and what it will do in the future. Little is said of the cold cash attitude of many of the sidemen and of the frightful trash the band has been turning out for the last 3 years. Charlie Barnett even felt compelled to defend him at this point, fellow band leader. He writes, "You're right that Ellington sounds dispirited and tired a lot of the time these days. But who the hell doesn't? Do you have any idea what it's like night after night playing to sparse crowds and unenthusiastic ones at that? How many places like Bop City you think there are now where a band can sit down and even catch its breath? The things I admit are wrong about Ellington, just as you do, are a reflection of the whole business today, not just Duke. And don't forget for 1 minute, if Duke goes down, the whole horse show goes right down on a toboggan with him. Ellington may not be causing any comment this year because neither is anybody else." Mm-mm-mm. Here's a track from that exact period of time called "Smarter." Maybe like, "What's smarter, you?" On American at Radio, 90.3 WHBC. We'll be right back. Nice, right?
Yeah.
Now, perhaps this next paragraph from Cohen's book will clarify what's happening here, though. Now, he's finally free of RCA and his racist boss.
Thank God.
And he's signed to Columbia with a very, very sympathetic producer named George Ivakian, one of the most important men in jazz in this era.
Huh.
Before the Ellington Orchestra was allowed to premiere new material on LPs at Columbia, they recorded a bevy of songs that ranged the musical gamut. Many obviously waxed in hopes of scoring a hit single. I think we just heard one.
Huh.
In a brief 3-month period, they completed at least 40 sides, an unusually prodigious effort. The flurry of recordings resulted from the imminence of another recording ban by the American Federation of Musicians. Like, one wasn't enough. Set to take effect at the close of 1947. Labels stockpiled as many discs as possible to release during the strike, which ended up lasting 50 weeks.
Wow.
Ellington waived his usual advance so the company would accumulate plenty of Ellington product to release during the strike. We would record almost anything at all. We were going a mile a minute in those days, recalled George Ivakian,
wow,
Ellington's main producer at Columbia during this period and the executive in charge of the pop record division. Now, George Ellington at Columbia proved an excellent partner for Ellington in his commitment to musical development. The huge success of the album division that he headed at Columbia allowed latitude most record executives did not enjoy. Albums sold at an even more profitable rate than singles in terms of dollar volume, Ivakian recalled. Singles were listed at 99 cents, albums $3.95. So a million-seller album was like a 4-million-seller single, very rare occurrence. And therefore, the album department brought in far more money than anybody suspected. By 1953, the LP format that Columbia introduced brought in over $200 million per year for the record industry. Besides doing well in America, albums opened up the European market to American record companies like never before, providing additional revenue and creating more justification for signing artists like Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Errol Gardner, who all sold better in Europe than domestically. This situation and Ivakian's long-term love and respect for Ellington's music led to a large amount of artistic freedom. Anything he wanted to do, I was all for. Even though I would sometimes feel, well, this particular song doesn't have a chance to be a hit single, Ivakian explained. Hell, give the man a shot. He's earned it. If Duke Ellington wanted something, I saluted. Thank you, George Ivakian. What he did at this point in time was he allowed Ellington to revisit songs that, unlike when he was on RCA and they released an album of Duke playing his greatest hits,
right,
in a really like by rote manner, he let Duke rewrite the charts to his own hits,
nice,
and extend them. We've heard Mood Indigo a number of times. Here is what happened when he got to Columbia. He rewrote Mood Indigo and turned it into a 15-minute piece of gigantic orchestration. This is pretty glorious, I think, that moment on American Radio 90.3 WHPC, the 15-minute, 28-second version of Mood Indigo.
Thank you.
I could live it down and die.
that feeling ghostly.
Thank you.
while Ellington is being demeaned by the press, he pretty much proves that he might very well be the first jazz musician to truly get the potential of the LP format and its possibilities.
Right.
He rewrites a popular song that was a 3.5 minute maximum length as a on a 78 RPM record, and he extends it to 15 and a half minutes for albums.
It didn't feel too long.
No, and it's a stroke of genius, right? Yeah. It feels like it's beautifully paced. And now he starts to write original music, really deeply, almost surreal. This track that we're going to end with is called The Tattooed Bride. And it's another extended piece that Ellington put on the same album for Columbia Records. We'll come back and we'll continue this next week because we're out of time. I really want to make sure I can play The Tattooed Bride in its entirety. But who even remembers that Ellington would write it something called The Tattooed Bride at a time when he was essentially forgotten? It's a shame. So I hope you enjoy it now on American at Radio, 90.3 WHPC. Duke Ellington and his orchestra with The Tattooed Bride.
Thank you.